Today on Flashpoints, we continue our live broadcast from the Multicultural Indigenous Academy in St. Paul, Minnesota. AIM activists hold the line in a protest at the site of the most egregious public spectacle in U.S. history. Indeed, on Flashpoints, we'll feature an in-depth look at the mass hanging of dozens of members of the Dakota Nation at Fort Snelling in St. Paul. Also on Flashpoints, so-called lawmakers and delegates continue the pomp and circumstance at the Republican National Convention. Will feature an in-depth discussion on international treaty rights and the lawless actions of the U.S. government against Indian peoples. We'll conclude the broadcast with interviews and sounds from last night's Poor People's March. I'm Dennis Bernstein with Miguel Gavilan Molina and special Flashpoints guest host from St. Paul, AIM leader Bill Means. Well, we welcome you back here to the police state of St. Paul, where we report from the shadows of the RNC and where there seems to be more cops, soldiers, and federal agents than ants crawling underground. We begin the broadcast with AIM leader Two Bear, and let me tell you something about what's going on here. This is the 150th anniversary week of the founding of the state of Minnesota. Politicians around the state and at the RNC are recognizing the date as an important milestone in the state's history. Well, invisible in the celebrations are the real stewards and original peoples of the land. It is common knowledge that this state and the entire country was founded on land inhabited by Native Americans who were forcibly relocated off their homeland or simply exterminated outright. The American Indian Movement and members of the indigenous community have gathered to call attention to this attempted genocide and remember some of the atrocities that took place in the name of progress and democracy. Several teepees at a campsite were erected in the shadow of Fort Snelling, where in 1862, 35 members of the Dakota Nation were hung in the largest group hanging in U.S. history. We spoke with one of the organizers, Two Bear, of the American Indian Movement. Two Bear greeted us in his native language and explained why he had set up camp and what they hoped to accomplish symbolically and legally in the courts.
Ho mitanku yapi wasi chantewa shtena pechiu sapido matonum pa makyapi. The first sentence I said was a standard greeting used by the Dakota, Lakota, and Nakota people, which says, "Hello, my relatives. With a good heart, I greet all of you with a handshake." And then I just said that I am Two Bear, Matonumpa Makyapi. We're calling this reclaiming sacred sites. And there's the spring over there, cold water spring. And that's why we're here. And we're doing the strategy we planned was four nights of ceremonies. And the purpose would be to reclaim then the cold water spring that way. And then we're testing Article 3 of the Treaty of 1805. Which says the U.S. promise on their part to permit the Sioux to pass, repass, and hunt, and do other things as they have formerly done in said district. So that means to live here as our people have done, to hunt and fish, grow crops, to have access to sacred sites, conduct ceremonies, protect our burial mounds, everything that our people have done. And to me, it's kind of ironic, you know, these things are people have done for centuries, thousands of years, and here is this country that's 232 years old saying we can't get water from the spring to use for an inipi, to use for ceremonies. So that's what we're testing now. So if we get arrested, and hopefully without getting our heads bashed by the SWAT team, that, we want to get this into the U.S. courts and push it as far as we can in an effort to regain the land. And the treaty itself is about covers about 155,000 acres of land. Most of St. Paul and a great deal of Minneapolis is in that treaty. So, like, if you go downtown Minneapolis, if you find St. Anthony Falls, that's between the 3rd Avenue Bridge and the 10th Avenue Bridge. And that's where the northernmost area is. So anyway, that's where it is. And so, and the other thing I wanted to say, and furthermore, we'll be eventually testing Article 2, which deals with consideration money, mazaska. And there, Zebulon Pike, who negotiated for the United States government, estimated the value of this 155,000 acres to be worth about $200,000. However, when it got back to Washington, D.C., the Senate put in the sum of $2,000. And so even at my old age, with my memory going and all that, I don't need a calculator to figure out that we're $198,000 short. So we want to ask for $198,000 from 2005 to up to the present day. And then two major issues are involved in land reparations, payment for the land, and then land restitution, return of some of that land, especially state and federal land within that 155,000 acres. We don't know what's going to happen, but once we get in the U.S. courts, we're hoping to push it as far as we can go.
As you suggested, you actually might get into the U.S. courts before you actually get to it on this issue. Have you been warned? We see that there's a sheriff passing right now as we speak. Is there some warning? Are they going to clear you off this land before you sort of complete your ritual?
I don't know. I mean, the way they've been coming, it seems like it. We have a permit. Yesterday was D-Day, 3 o'clock. We were supposed to be out of here. But we had the teepee set up, the sacred fire going, and our cook tent over here going, and so there we were. Their troops were massing at the gates up here, and then a couple of minutes before 3 o'clock, the manager of Fish and Wildlife comes down and gives us a permit for 4 days, and we didn't ask for that. They gave it to us. I suppose in like the article this morning's paper said, maybe because it was the Republican National Convention, and then there's press from all over the world here, and if that came out, that it wouldn't make Minnesota look good, you know, or at all. So we don't know if that's right or not. That's pure speculation on that.
What about is there a historical point? Why this moment in history to take this action now?
Right now, I don't know if I can really answer that question. All I can say from what I know about our people, we have been so badly beaten down, oppressed, that I always say these kind of actions that we're doing now is a sign that we're starting to awaken from our colonial slumber. Because we've been, you know, our people, like where I come from, we say we don't want even blatant acts of discrimination in town. We don't want to do anything because we might get the white people more mad at us. So we don't do anything. And so, but now as our people are getting better educated, I think that's true with all the indigenous peoples. As the young people are coming up and working with their traditional people, the elders, it's a great combination that start to make assertions now. And that we have treaty rights, and that's what we want to assert. We have treaty rights.
And whose land, if the original owners or stewards of the land are given back this land, whose land is it?
There'd be the Dakota Oyate of Minnesota, and then particularly probably would work with the Mendota Dakota community, because they're not a federally recognized government, so they're not under the Bureau of Indian Affairs, under the Department of Interior, but they would be under the Treaty of 1805, so they could be an international entity and handle land, so that our people who are dispersed throughout the Nebraska, the Dakotas, Montana, a couple provinces of Canada, if some of them want to come back, you know, that we could, maybe they could get land from there. At least that's the idealized thinking anyway. So
I want to ask you, as you sit here on this sacred site, the Republicans are holding their convention just a couple of miles away down the road. How would you put into context what you're doing here with that going on there? What does that have to do with this?
That party, as well as the Democratic Party, represent a nation that some 500 years ago began to invade our lands, began to occupy our lands, began to steal our lands, began to exploit our lands, resources, and the people, and which have resulted, and also began to break treaties with our people, over 400 of them, and also which perpetrated genocide upon our people in the past 500 years. And so that's how, in my mind, I view what's going on there, that neither party really is that is innocent. They're all responsible and complicit in the traumatic, tragic history of indigenous peoples here in the United States of America.
Could you just describe what happened here in the early 1800s, the horrible action taken by the U.S. government, which led to perhaps the largest mass hanging in history?
Well, again, like one of the things I'm always saying to the Minnesota Historical Society and colleges and institutions is that if we're going to talk about a history of the U.S. or talk about a history of a particular state, in this case Minnesota, that you cannot omit topics like massive land theft, like in with the U.S. over 3 billion acres of land stolen. And or you cannot omit broken treaties, over 400 treaties made and violated by the United States of America with indigenous peoples. You cannot omit genocide, which was perpetrated. I use the figure of 16 million native peoples within the continental United States at time of contact, and four centuries later, by 1900, there is only 237,000 plus of us left, less than a quarter million. In that four centuries, the question is, what happened? Well, we, some of us Native academics and non-Native academics say genocide happened. And that needs to be talked about. And in this state in particular, that's what I do a little bit of research, did quite a considerable bit of reading about that topic, and I present papers to the International Association of Genocide Scholars at different places around the world. But in here, if you take the five criteria of the 1948 UN Genocide Convention, the United States fulfilled all five criteria against the Dakota people, like killing members of the group. In some of the handouts that we're giving out, bounties were part of that as well. You know, it was $25, then $75, and finally $200 for every Redskin sent to purgatory, to quote one advertisement in the Winona Republican on September 23rd, 1863. And then, or like you, as you've mentioned, the largest mass execution in the history of the United States, warfare that was waged in order to steal, to exterminate or remove the Dakota people, the forced marches of our people, 1,700 of our people, primarily women, children, and elders, who were forced marched 150 miles from the southwestern Minnesota to the concentration camp at Fort Snelling. Two concentration camps here in Minnesota, one for the men at Mankato and one for the women, children, and elders at Fort Snelling, here, right here in the Twin Cities area. And then the last thing that I always like to say is the forced removal or ethnic cleansing of our people from the state of Minnesota, their ancient homeland of Minnesota Makoche, land where the waters reflect the skies or heavens. One other thing I'd like to say, as we are here in this beautiful area, this site of one of our sacred sites, Coldwater Spring, is that just right down below where the river Minnesota River meets the Mississippi River is our origin story, that according to the Bidewa Kantuma Dakota, dwellers by Mystic Lake, that's where our Dakota Garden of Eden is placed. So in a way, this area is, as Jim Anderson likes to say, is site of Dakota Genesis, then also site of Dakota Genocide. And so with that, I think you got a kind of an idea of what some of the things that have happened to our people here, and that the Sesquicentennial Commission, you know, Minnesota is celebrating their 150 years of statehood, and we as Dakota people are saying there is nothing to celebrate for the Dakota people, and we're asking them, the state of Minnesota, the Sesquicentennial Commission, to begin telling the truth about what really happened with the Dakota people here in Minnesota.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
And we do thank you, Tuber. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. As we say now, we're broadcasting from St. Paul, the police state of St. Paul, Minnesota. And we're going to continue our discussion of laws, lawmakers, and lawbreakers. Here we are in the shadow of the Republican Convention. Many so-called lawmakers in the indigenous community, in Indian country, these are lawbreakers who have led the way to the stealing of Indian lands and a near genocide of Indian peoples. We're going to talk about now about migration as opposed to immigration and international law, international treaties. Let me tell you, we're honored to have our honorary co-host, Bill Means, of the American Indian Movement back at the table. Bill, welcome back.
Oh, good to be here again.
Good to have you. And also joining us is an old friend of this broadcast, Tony Gonzalez. He's the director of AIM West Coast. He's a consultant for the United Nations on the indigenous affairs, and he's been working a night and day, really, to create human rights and international treaty rights for indigenous peoples in this hemisphere. I thank you, Tony Gonzalez, for coming back and coming all the way here to St. Paul to be with us. Son,
I wouldn't miss it.
And I'm glad you wouldn't. We would want to miss you since you're here. Why don't you begin? Now, a lot of people talk about immigration. What's the difference between migration and immigration in the context of international treaties?
Well, in terms of the Americas, for example, and the migratory, traditional migratory routes that people have been making since time immemorial, if you will, from South America to the north and from the north to the south and across, these are migratory routes, of the two-legged, if you will. But certainly we know that the four-legged knows no boundaries and borders and will continue to cross the Americas as they have. And the flying relatives also cross, migrating. And so it is with traditional Indian people that the route continues. And as opposed to those that are immigrating from either the east or the west in the Americas, the United Nations has declared a cyclical dilemma here, where over 300 million people are in mass migration, and by and large, this mass migration in the world is attributed to economic purposes, reasons, trade agreements that have gone awry without involvement and consent of the citizenry, and in many cases, people directly affected, the indigenous peoples. So there is a lot to talk about on immigration and migration. The United Nations has also developed its intergovernmental bodies as well to address this situation. The International Organization on Migration, for example, that are meeting periodically addressing problems, whether in Pakistan, Iraq, Bolivia, Ecuador, and Mexico. There's also at the international level the Convention on immigrant and migrant families that the United States, by the way, is not a signature to. It has been ratified by over 35 countries, so it's moving toward adoption by consensus, at precious point, because it would be a convention that would be really looked at here in the United States with regard to migrant families and the immigration issue in general. But Dennis, and to the listeners, I might say that people are frustrated and angry because a solution hasn't been found nor even discussed by the public, and yet these walls are going up down in Mexico and U.S., by Homeland Security. It is intensifying, and I think one way to demonstrate their concern and this issue that needs to be addressed by either Republican or Democratic candidate or third-party candidate for that matter, it's an issue that's coming to the floor, and it's going to be at the very top. And so I think we have to look at it very carefully. October 13, which is a Monday next month, has been declared. In California, for example, it is a state holiday. A lot of people refer to it as Columbus Day. And to peoples of the Americas, as we talked earlier, it is a significant day referred to as Día de la Raza, or the Day for the People. Indigenous Peoples Day is what we will be referring this to, and we'll be developing popular support to launch a campaign to call on the presidential candidates, whomever they are, to consider signing this declaration on the rights of the world's indigenous peoples, of which I might say three countries in the world have not signed the declaration: Canada, New Zealand, and the United States. So this is what we're pushing on, the big issue on immigration and migration, and who are the pilgrims here on this land.
Bill Means, you think they're discussing international treaty rights down the block here at the RNC?
I think they're discussing the high moral ground that they seem to have lost in terms of their constant reminder about moral values and family values. They're reconsidering that there are some realities amongst our young people and in America that need to be addressed, like teenage pregnancy, like unprotected sex. These are things that we see hopefully they'll discuss over here in St. Paul, because it seems as though the Republicans have withdrawn all social service report, dollars or benefits in that area, because they kept talking about family values, welfare reform, and now it's right within the presidential and vice presidential candidates' everyday reality.
Well, let me ask you something, Bill. A lot of the work that AIM has done is to, build consciousness, build solidarity through coalitions and efforts and actions. And also, AIM has pioneered into the World Court, or the United Nations, the whole questions of treaties. I do know that AIM has an arm that deals specifically with treaties on an international level, in which I believe you are a member of the board of the International Indian Treaty Council. Can you tell us a little bit about that work?
Well, beginning in 1974, which now looks like about 34 years, we decided to take advantage of the international attention that Indian people were having due to the occupation of Wounded Knee in 1973 and the resulting 500 criminal trials that took place after that particular confrontation between Indian peoples and the United States government on the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation in South Dakota, the poorest reservation, I might add, in America, and the poorest county in America. So, yes, directed by the elder people, they asked that we convene a council, a conference in which we would invite the various traditional treaty men and women. These are the people who kept the documents, in their trunks. These are the people that held the oral history of what the treaties mean to our people, not only in terms of paper and writing on paper, but what they mean in terms of seven generations' survival into the future. What the treaties mean in terms of putting your spiritual and moral authority behind your signature or your X on a piece of paper. And also using what became known as a peace pipe is not really a peace pipe. What the Indian people brought that pipe to the negotiations, and you might say endorsed the treaty through the smoking of that pipe, which means they communicated with the Creator as well, to endorse and to confirm and to ratify that treaty. We had to involve the Creator as well as our whole nation of people. And so, taking that direction from the elders, they said, well, we're going to give you two simple mandates out of this conference. One is to create an international voice, an international organization that could represent the human rights issues of all indigenous peoples, not just Indian tribes in North America or the U.S., but people don't realize there's 80 million Indian people south of the U.S.-Mexico border. The only difference, they were colonized by the Spanish-speaking peoples of Europe, and therefore they speak Spanish as opposed to English. But there are relatives. There are people who we feel are direct descendants, us of them, them of us. And so we've had all these international trade routes that are guaranteed to us by treaty. So when we went to the United Nations, the other simple mandate was to use our treaties as our legal foundation on the standing we would have at the United Nations. And once Jimmy Carter started going around pointing a finger at various governments, especially in the Americas and throughout the world, saying they are in violation of human rights, once he did that, it had a, what you might call, a double reaction. Because all the countries of the world said, it seems like I remember there were some indigenous peoples in the United States who have a history of human rights violations as well. And so they began to come to the UN seeking information. Well, up until the time we were there, when somebody wanted to know about American Indians, the U.S. government referred them to the Bureau of Indian Affairs, which, of course, is the colonial administration arm of the U.S. government in the Department of Interior. And so you can imagine what kind of conditions they talked about. And so this treaty was our entree into the United Nations, not to represent tribal governments or colonial governments, but to represent nations. And that's the important part, because treaties are signed between nations, not tribal governments. They're not signed between labor unions. They're not signed between universities. Treaties, according to Article 6 of the United States Constitution, are the supreme law of the land. And so, therefore, that was our entree, using the vast experience, the foresight, the wisdom of the elders. They saw that we could enter into the international community because we had exhausted all domestic remedies. And so the only logical next step is to go to the international community on the basis of human rights violations.
But let me ask you, Bill and Tony, you know, it seems like, you know, the world, you know, has voted to accept a declaration with the exception of three countries. Now, what does that mean, you know, to indigenous rights in this country and particularly here in the Americas? Without the U.S. participating or taking part, how, what mechanisms is there within the United Nations to enforce some of these rights of indigenous peoples?
Yes, I think the declaration itself at this point needs to be looked at in three particular categories. For example, those countries that chose to adopt the declaration, of which there was 143 countries, those countries that abstained from adopting the Declaration on the Rights of the World's Indigenous Peoples, of which there were 11 countries, And then looking at it in the third category, of those countries that did not sign the declaration, which includes those that that I mentioned. Now, looking at it in that way, then the strategy for each of those three categories needs to be developed and approached accordingly. For example, countries that have adopted the declaration on the rights of the world's indigenous peoples, for example, included Bolivia. And Evo Morales, the president of Bolivia, has gone further than any other country in the world, not only adopting the Declaration on the Rights of the World's Indigenous Peoples through the General Assembly of the UN, but they have gone to the extent of including it now in the Constitution. So once it's in its Constitution, into the fabric, the fiber of its governance, then it's up to them to also now develop the regulations, the rules, the law by which to enforce or implement their constitutional law that they've now adopted. So that is to say that those countries that have adopted the declaration, now it would be most encouraging if they included it within their constitution, and which is another matter in itself. Those countries that that chose to abstain, like Russia, for example, and others, are in another particular situation where they have yet to acknowledge the indigenous peoples in those territories and to reach agreements as to what extent or what are the limitations that they want to set up, for the indigenous peoples within those territories. And then, of course, there is that category like the United States and Canada and New Zealand, who have not only chosen to refuse to adopt the declaration, but the implications of that means that they also refuse to acknowledge that they had practiced a policy of extermination. It means that they refuse to acknowledge that they were out to commit genocide against the peoples. It means that that they failed to acknowledge the inherent rights of indigenous peoples. So we have our work cut out in those countries where they have refused, Canada and the United States and in New Zealand. Now, for the United States, the issue that you talked about with regards to treaties, for example, and we talked about several things here. We talk about sacred sites, for example. We talk about an indigenous person's right to an identity, a person's right to an education. All of these are particular articles within the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People that your listeners should be, you know, getting on the internet and checking out at www.un.org and look for the declaration, and you will see that the articles that refer to treaties, and in this case the local issue here that we talked about, the 1862 treaty that Bill Means had mentioned earlier, is that can be referred to in the declaration if and when we get that adopted here by the candidates and the country itself. But I think I don't have it just here with me, but Articles 10, 11, and 12 refer to land and what to do when land is not being used any longer by the governments.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. I'm here with Miguel Gavilan Molina. You just heard Tony Gonzalez. He's the director of AIM on the West Coast. He's a consultant for the UN on Indigenous Affairs. And also at the table with us is Bill Means. He is on the board of the American Indian Movement, and he is a leader in the international treaty movement. Bill, the Republican Convention has continue to, if you will, cleanse the American Indian Movement from their convention, despite the fact that they're in the heart of Indian country. Do you think this is an overt action, like the attempt to cleanse this hemisphere of indigenous people, or do they don't even, or they just don't remember anymore?
Well, it's certainly overt, but I think it's a common tool of colonialism. Is in order to make colonialism a reality on a reservation, you have to create a small elite, and those if there is any elite in Indian country, I believe it. Many of them could be Republican. As we said in the past, we don't see many Indian Republicans. However, it's our obligation to challenge them on the issues. Because, as we have said in the past, some Republicans, Richard Nixon for one, have been very, should we say, dynamic in dealing with Indian issues that we haven't seen duplicated by Democrats. And the other area that I'd like to relate to that seems to be cleansed from the agenda of both parties is the issue of migration. We say migration, not immigration. And what I wanted to touch on is the racist kind of ideology that is being used in the present policy, because it seems as though to us indigenous people, when the people were immigrating to the United States based on these posters all over Europe that said free land, they didn't tell the people it was our land that was free land. And not only that, created Ellis Island. The French gave a statue that said, "Give me your tired, your hungry, your huddled masses. Welcome to America." What we need on the southern border of the U.S. is a Statue of Liberty, not a wall, like the wall that divides Palestine and Israel, like the wall that divided Germany, like the wall that used to be called the Iron Curtain. Are these the type of policies? Are these the type of examples that America wants to follow? I mean, it's just because it's brown people coming from the South, it's a migration. Civilizations throughout history have migrated to find a better way of life for their family. Now they're doing jobs that no Americans want to do. And yet they're still sending over $12 billion a year from America back to Latin American countries, as one of the largest industries that they have in Latin America is sending back American dollars made by migrants, as we call them, not immigrants. And so they are contributing not only to our society through Social Security taxes, through other state taxes they pay, but they're contributing to the economies of Latin America more so than NAFTA. And so as NAFTA tears down economies, people are attempting to rebuild their communities through the money they make in America. So America will be stronger by embracing our relatives from the South as opposed to putting up a wall that is embarrassment to the history of America.
And again, you're listening to Flashpoints. We're in St. Paul. Let me say, we just have a minute or two left, Bill. And this school has been under siege in the sense that we have seen every kind of cop, from local cops, regional cops, federal cops, Homeland Security, trainloads full of soldiers, Navy SEALs, you name it. The National Security Forces are here. We've got F-16s flying overhead. What's your reaction? I mean, this seems to be getting worse, and they've been cleansing activists from the streets. Is this surprising to you? What's your response to this?
Well, as a military veteran from Vietnam, I look at this whole exercise as a practice for implementation of martial law wherever it's needed, whether that's on the border, whether that's in relationship to terrorism, whether that's in relationship to, should we say, taking by force the natural resources left in America. I think they're practicing for the implementation of martial law, and without using, and this is a term that's going to become very prevalent in the non-Indian community, free, prior, and informed consent. Who consented to all these police? We thought we had a nice community here at St. Paul. Matter of fact, the St. Paul police were actually viewed as a lot more lenient, a lot more friendly, a lot more neighborhood-orientated than Minneapolis. And now all of a sudden the people are saying, St. Paul are saying, what did you do to our city? And so I think it's a tremendous embarrassment for the community relations and the police department to see these thugs running around under the badge of American federal forces and denying the rights of the people.
All right. Well, Bill Means, Tony Gonzalez, an incredibly enlightening discussion about things that are definitely not being talked about at the Republican National Convention here in St. Paul. Again, Bill, honor to have you at the table with us and be supported by the American Indian Movement. Tony Gonzalez, as always, we learn a lot from your presence at the table, and we hope that you'll both keep educating us and this country about what really happened and the nature of the attempted genocide that we need to take responsibility for and, if you will, make amends. I'm Dennis Bernstein. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Now we move to hear an interview by Flashpoints La Luna correspondent Evelina Molina directly from yesterday's Poor People's Economic Human Rights March. Evelina.
Reporting for Flashpoints on Pacifica, I'm Evelina Molina. Just as the phoenix, consumed in flames, arises from the ashes of destruction, so arises once again the dream of Martin Luther King Jr.'s 1967 Poor People's Campaign, a movement intended to broadly address economic inequalities with nonviolent action that abruptly ended in June of 1968 with his assassination. Today's 21st century civil rights movement continues in the form of the Poor People's Economic Human Rights Campaign. This modern-day working-class struggle is committed to uniting the poor across national boundaries as the leadership base for a broad movement to abolish poverty. We joined the march at Mears Park, downtown St. Paul, where it began as several thousand protesters, passionate and angry, wound their way through the streets lined with heavily armed police, National Guard, and officials from Homeland Security. We spoke with several kids on the protest route, as well as Rosa Clemente, the Green Party candidate for vice president. Here's a spunky, articulate, 10-year-old girl named Yanelle, who knew exactly why she was marching.
I'm here to protest that we need that what we need to get to the homeless so we can, get them home. So, because it breaks my heart when I go home and see homeless people on the streets. I feel bad. One day, they asked me, can they, me and my dad was walking, they asked me, can they buy me something to eat? So my dad took her in and brought her all this bag of food and brought her a little cabin. And I felt better.
Did you see all those police officers around?
Yeah, I was kind of scared because I don't really be around all the police. And when they had the spray, I thought off the movies, they was gonna spray and then we all gonna cough and stuff. And I was getting scared and I was gonna cry. But then I said, what am I going for? I'm gonna scream my heart out.
And now you're around all these people. How do you feel right now?
I feel good to myself. I'm helping the homeless, what I always wanted to do. I'm doing photography sometimes. And I feel better when I'm jumping on what I used to do. So I just jumping on a train.
Do you feel safe around all these people or are you scared?
No, I'm not scared anymore. But yeah, I'm good.
Okay. And is your dad or your mom here?
My mom and my brother is over there.
And are they also helping the homeless?
Yes, they are helping the homeless.
Oh, great. And what do you want to do when you get older?
When I get older, if it's just still going on, I'm coming back.
All right. And what do you want to tell other kids about what they should be doing?
They should be coming down to Minnesota.
We can't pay the politicians to vote the right way and to pass the right laws. All we have is our voices. And I love this little boy here very much. Do you have something to say? He's been wanting to chant all day.
Yeah, Guillermo. Come on, Guillermo. Guillermo.
Take their parents away. What do they expect? expect these young Latinos, brothers and sisters, to survive on these streets. They only have one way, and that's to take back what's theirs. So the Green Party says amnesty. There's no negotiation with that. We won't negotiate with human life ever.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We are here in St. Paul in the Twin Cities, doing our version of the coverage of the Republicrats conventions. And we're delighted to be joined here, of all places, in Minnesota by an old friend of ours, Ethel Longscott. Why don't you just say a little bit about where you work and the kinds of work you've been doing, and then we'll talk about what's been happening here.
Absolutely. I'm really glad to be here with your audience. I come from the great state of California and straight out of Oaktown, Oakland, California. I direct the Women's Economic Agenda Project, and for about 26 years, we have been focused on this notion that women and their families, and indeed all families, need this small thing called economic security and justice. We have applied ourselves in a multitude of ways to try to secure this, but most importantly, we have been really fond of this notion that these are basic fundamental human rights. We didn't always approach it that way, but we found that that allowed us a mechanism to build unity, to provide a strategic approach to fighting our problems, and also to work with others who are about the business of securing those same rights for others.
All right. When you say economics and economic justice is a human right, talk a little bit about that.
Well, these basic fundamental things called housing, health care, education, the right to sustenance, clean air, a clean planet, these are all basic human dignities that people need in order to secure not only for ourselves in the immediate sense, but for the future. And I think just an integral part of what we've tried to kind of hold as an important concept, fighting forward in the future, but holding these concepts of what we need to do to secure our immediate needs, ensuring that the women and children are up and off the streets, not being silent in the face of such profound abundance and the tremendous suffering of our people, but also not losing sight of the fact that we have a tradition not only of resistance, but of a fight to liberate humanity. So we really stand and affirm that we are a part of a tradition of fighting forward for that. So that tapestry, those aspirations are what we have been trying to secure, and we really believe that it will take we the people in our multitudes in broad social movements aimed towards these kinds of policies and priorities to secure that.
Now, you have been doing this work for a little bit, and that gives you a special viewpoint, because you've seen things occur over a long curve. We're here listening to some very troubling stories that grow out of extreme poverty in this very wealthy country. Talk about what you're doing here in this church, and maybe talk a little bit about if you see things getting worse, or is there some improvement?
I'm really glad you asked that. I think the key thing that we see is this growth of this profound poverty and wealth in our country and on a global level. And sometimes people see it as only talking about the poor, but I rather, my studies and my travels tell me that we're really looking at this growth of the dispossessed. Now, what I mean by that is, if you're not part of the ruling clique and elite that is meeting at one of these two conventions, you basically are on the outs. And if not today, you are one healthcare calamity, one job loss, or a condition that you can't begin to met out for your family. The dispossessed is a growing number, and that is a really different way to approach this. So this notion that we as middle America, we got a job, we have certain security, man, it can be threatened the next day. And that's what we're focusing on today. What is the relationship of the most destitute to the rest of Americans, and how we must keep that concept, as Dr. King did, of lifting all those boats, of providing economic human rights to all as being our foremost responsibility.
Would you say that poverty and just being poor in this country has really been criminalized to the point where it's sort of dangerous to be poor?
Oh, it absolutely is dangerous unless you are helping to fuel the prison industry in the state, in the great state of California. It is one of the growing industries of some 20 new prisons have been built in the past decade, and it has not done, in the past two decades, and has not done one thing to stem the tide of hunger, of desperation. My town of Oakland, we're facing at least a killing a night. Our children find no opportunity, and we have to step up. That's really the tremendous. So things are much more desperate for those who are locked out of economic opportunity, jobs, health care, the ability to take care of themselves, and they're being forced into a situation where it's choosing, society has thrown them away, and they are responding in kind. That is the worst of America. I think we have the opportunity to step forward and assert our rights and assert the better part of our country.
Finally, in the context of this convention and all the people gathered here, there were tens of thousands in a march today. We have seen dozens, scores, hundreds of police, preventative police actions. Are you expecting to see more of this? Does the poverty level and the desperation of people feed into the need for the police state to expand their numbers?
Well, no, I think, Dennis, that this measure of crushing our democratic rights has risen right along with the crushing of our economic freedoms and our economic opportunity. And we're at a crossroads in America. Who will prevail? These law enforcement police state measures that try to shut down the voices of dissent? Tomorrow we convene in the most sacred tradition possible. We raise our voices against power. We put our hearts and bodies on the line to say that we are the true patriots of America, and those who seek to try and silence us are in fact the ones who spit on the tradition of the men and women, our forefathers, our foremothers, who built this country, and we reject them, we reject their proposals.
We know, finally, that these attacks and all these police are meant to intimidate people like you, to shut you down, to convince you that it's too dangerous to protest. Do you feel intimidated?
More power to the people? Absolutely not. But most importantly, because we know that they're the Rust Belt of America, from Iowa into the Deep South and across to California and across to New York City, that there are people awakening because they're hurting and they're beginning to understand that these proposals by the global elite is not our proposals, that we, the working people of this country, some employed, some not, must craft our own independent class proposals. It is time, it is necessary, and nothing short of humanity's future is at stake. So we, though, are afraid of our of potential impact on our physical bodies, know that we are on the right side of history and take the moral high ground.
And thank you, Ethel Long Scott. Before I say goodbye, this is Dennis Bernstein with Miguel Gavilan Molina from St. Paul. Final words from Bill Means, remembering one of the leaders in this indigenous community in the home of the American Indian Movement. Bill.
Yes, Dennis. Dedicating our broadcast today to Steve High Eagle Blake, 51-year-old Red Lake Nation Ojibwe. He was the president of AIM here in Minneapolis, St. Paul. He passed away from complications of a lung transplant early this morning. Services will be at the Native American Church on 22nd Bloomington in Minneapolis beginning tomorrow at 4 o'clock. And we remember Steve and his family, especially his mother, his children, and his wife. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Bill Means, Tony Gonzalez, Miguel Gavilan Molina Falcone at the board. Thank you, Evelina Molina, and the entire Flashpoints crew. We have to say goodbye right now. Thanks. Stay tuned.